You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to All Creatures Podcast. I'm your host, Angie, and today I'll be talking with tree kangaroo conservation expert, Dr. Lisa Daybeck from the Woodland Park Zoo in Seattle, Washington. Dr. Daybeck started the tree kangaroo conservation program in 1996 as part of her graduate research project on machis, we'll talk about that in the podcast in a bit, tree kangaroo, which is a personal favorite of mine because the Machi's tree kangaroo, I get to see them all the time at the Santa Fe College Teaching Zoo where my husband works. So the Tree Kangaroo Conservation Project is still very active and continues to collaborate with local communities to protect the forests of the Huon Peninsula and help the Machi's tree kangaroo benefit and grow their populations alongside helping local communities. So make sure and stick around today as we'll be talking all about tree kangaroos with Dr. Daybeck. We'll be talking about conservation efforts to save them in the wild, and we'll also probably be talking about how cute they are. So hello, Dr. Daybeck. So nice to see you.
Oh, it's very nice to be here.
I know. I was so happy that my husband, Jonathan, knew you just from his career all these years. And when I said we were covering tree kangaroo on the podcast, he was like, I have the perfect person for you to talk to answer all your questions and to get more excited about tree kangaroo conservation. So
that's just great.
Yeah.
And I know that the Santa Fe Teaching Zoo has had tree kangaroos for so long, and it's a wonderful place. So it's a real pleasure to be here.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, as we get started, I was just wondering if you could give our listeners a little bit of your background. You have an amazing, amazing background and portfolio. So when you were a kid, did you always want to work as a conservation scientist, or was there an aha moment that helped solidify your love for all things animals and nature?
So as my mom tells it, I've always loved animals. From when I was very, very little, I would only read books about animals. I only wanted to play with animals. So I knew always that I would do something with animals for my life. Whether that was going to be animal training or zookeeper or what, that I didn't really figure out until college. But actually, when I was at the University of California at Santa Cruz, and I started out as a biology major and then discovered environmental studies and ended up double majoring because I learned about conservation biology and connecting learning about the biology of animals with conserving them.
Yeah, we actually have our starts very similar in common. As a kid, I only wanted animals. Bless my grandmother's heart. She got me a doll one Christmas and I cried. I don't want that doll. Only stuffed animals. My poor grandmother. But bless her heart, she got me more stuffed animals and no dolls, no Barbies, no Cabbage Patch Kids, no nothing. And then when I went to Michigan State, I was zoology, but very early on in my time there, I tacked on environmental biology as well.
Oh, great.
Trying to learn more about the systems and how interconnected they are. It's always interesting to see how you just start loving one thing or one animal, and then it just unfolds into this beautiful career for you. And so you're currently at the Woodland Park Zoo. I was wondering if you could share with us how you got there after your time in Santa Cruz, and then what your current job is and some of your favorite parts about it.
Yeah, I've actually been associated with the Woodland Park Zoo since the 1980s. So after UC Santa Cruz, I was an intern at the National Zoo at the Smithsonian Institution, and then started graduate school and eventually got to the University of Washington in Seattle. And because I had been at the National Zoo, I knew that doing research on animals, that zoos were a really great place for doing animal behavior research. And so I contacted the Woodland Park Zoo, and that was when I was introduced to tree kangaroos. I never had heard of tree kangaroos before. I knew nothing about Papua New Guinea, but there were two female tree kangaroos with young or joeys in their pouch at the zoo. And what I was told by the zookeepers was that no one knew anything about the behavior of tree kangaroos. And that was the beginning.
Wow. Yeah. And for our listeners that aren't familiar with the tree kangaroo, because every time the word is mentioned or I read it on my prompts or anything, it just, my heart just flutters and skips a beat because they're just so darn cute. And so I can see why you fell in love with them at the Woodland Park Zoo and wanted to study them and learn more about their behavior. But could you give our listeners just a little brief background on tree kangaroos, how many species they are, what they look like? That's, of course, that's the hook right there. And then just some of their behavior or any unique facts that you've learned during your tenure working with them.
Yeah. So tree kangaroos, and every time I mention tree kangaroos, people say, what do you mean? You know, kangaroos that live in trees? What is that about? So they are true kangaroos. They're in the kangaroo family. They're marsupials. So the mothers have pouches. And what's so special about kangaroos and tree kangaroos as well is the young or joeys are born the size of a lima bean. They crawl into their mother's pouch, and then they develop in the pouch for over a period of 5 to 7 months. And so it's an incredible reproductive strategy. And that's what I studied at first. So tree kangaroos are, they actually evolved from rock wallabies and eventually moved into the trees. And they evolved in Australia. And at the time, there was a land bridge between Australia and the island of New Guinea, moved up to the island of New Guinea. And then there was a lot of speciation, or, you know, more species occurred because it's such a rugged place in New Guinea that they got very isolated. So there are now two species of tree kangaroos in Australia, in Queensland, and there are 12 species on the island of New Guinea. So 14 species in total. I study the Machi's tree kangaroo, that species, but they're really an amazing animal in that they look like a combination of a little bear and a koala and a kangaroo. They've got a long tail, which they use for balance. It's not a prehensile tail. Their forelimbs are more the same size as their hind limbs, unlike terrestrial kangaroos. And they not only can hop, but they can climb trees. So their hind limbs can move independently, which is unusual for a kangaroo. They've got this beautiful fur, and especially with the Machi's tree kangaroo, the color of the fur, it's like a cinnamon honey color, and it's exactly the color of the moss in the trees where they live in the wild. So they're really camouflaged. But they have long claws for climbing trees, and the pads on their feet are very rough for climbing trees. So they're just this very interesting combination of features, and they really take the, or have gone into the niche or gotten the niche of monkeys, because there are no monkeys in the Australasia region. And so there was no, and they're leaf eaters, they're folivores. So they really took the niche of primates in the trees.
Yeah. And it's just so interesting. I just couldn't believe when I read that there's 14 species. But it makes sense as you're describing how rough and rugged it is there and how they filled the tree yes. niche. But even that changes depending on what part of the island you are or where you're at. And
exactly.
Just to double check, is it Machis or Matchies? My husband and I were up late debating one the night before I did the podcast. He kept saying it was Machis, and I was like saying Matchies. And so Matchy.
I have to agree with you. It's Matchies, although, you know, potato, potato, tomato, tomato, whatever. But the other option for the Matchies tree kangaroo is calling it the Huon tree kangaroo, because it's the only tree kangaroo species that lives on the Huon Peninsula. So it's endemic to the Huon Peninsula. So some people call it the Huon tree kangaroo. So gotcha. That may be a compromise for you and your husband.
That's very meat in the middle. And that's what marriage is, right? It's finding the Huon Peninsula in all things, right?
Like, exactly.
But it was really fascinating to find out that they live in just that small area, considering the island's pretty big. But that makes sense that there's just these different niches yes. and environments on the island where they just radiated out and evolved into separate species. And
yeah,
I, of course, am a little bit, I love the Matchies because I get to see them all the time. I think their coloration pattern is so beautiful, but they all look somewhat similar, just mostly differences in their coat color. Am I correct in saying that for the different species?
Actually, I mean, if you're a tree kangaroo connoisseur.
I love that. I want to be. I'm not yet, but I want to be.
Some of them are lankier or skinnier. So the grizzled tree kangaroo looks more like a terrestrial kangaroo, and they're considered a little bit more, quote, primitive. And then there's the good fellows and the Matchies that have that beautiful brown, you know, honey color. And then there's a black and white one, the Dengiso. And some of them, the Doria's tree kangaroo is all brown. It really looks, and it's kind of a huskier tree kangaroo. So it really looks like a bear. Oh, so actually they do look quite different.
Distinct. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So fascinating. And now, which species of tree kangaroo do you have at your zoo? And with that being said, do you have like a favorite interaction story that you can share with our listeners to just showcase their personality a little bit?
Yeah. So we have the Matchies tree kangaroo at Woodland Park Zoo. And in fact, all zoos in North America, there are about 20 zoos that have tree kangaroos. And Matchies tree kangaroos is the only species that in North American AZA zoos at this time. In 2005, there was a discussion internationally about breeding of tree kangaroos, because there aren't that many tree kangaroos in captivity. We have about 50 in North American zoos. And the other species that's in zoos is the Goodfellows tree kangaroo. And that's now in European zoos, Asian zoos, Australian zoos. Okay. So if you go to any zoo in North America, the only tree kangaroo species you'll find is the Matchies tree kangaroo. And when you ask about personality, they really do have distinct personalities. And one of the things that I love about working based at a zoo is working with the zookeepers. and they really know their animals. And we have at Woodland Park Zoo currently, we have two females. They each have Joeys right now, and we have one male. One of the females, her name is Alana. She has had quite a few Joeys, offspring, and they always call her, you know, she can be kind of snarky. She can be kind of fussy. She's got a lot of personality, but she's a great mom. And I think the thing that I love about tree kangaroos is the first thing that I studied about them was the mother-young interactions and the behavioral development of the young. And it's amazing how they raise their young, because they have to not only train them what to eat and so on, but they have to get the Joeys familiar with a three-dimensional arboreal habitat. So unlike terrestrial kangaroos, where the Joeys can, you know, pop out of the pouch and start hopping, they have to learn how to climb in the trees. And the moms spend a lot of time. So they have a really long mother-young bond, like at least 18 months, which is very long.
Yes. When I read that too, I was like, yeah, that's super fascinating, especially for a marsupial.
Yes. Yeah. So that was one of the things that I studied for my graduate work, was the difference between tree kangaroo adaptations and terrestrial kangaroos. And that length of mother-young bond is one of the big things. Yeah.
So interesting. Yeah. And now we probably, or if we did our job right, Dr. Daybeck,
yes,
our listeners probably have fallen in love with tree kangaroos and want to hear all about their conservation and how they can help protect them. But in case you haven't already fallen in love with the tree kangaroo, why should people in general care about this unique creature and want to help save them?
Yeah, so tree kangaroos, I mean, they are incredibly special, incredibly cute, especially the young, the Joeys. And if you ever get the opportunity, you know, to Google or look at videos or go to a zoo and see tree kangaroos, they're just adorable and very furry. And that's one thing that I didn't mention before, is that they live very high up in the cloud forests. Even though they live in the tropics, it's at a high elevation rainforest, which is a cloud forest. And so they are adapted for cold weather. And so their fur is very thick and very lush. But tree kangaroos, the way I view it is that they are the flagship for the rainforest of New Guinea. And so when you save tree kangaroos, you save a whole suite of amazing species of birds, of mammals, of insects, of reptiles. And also you save the whole ecosystem. And so a lot of what I focus on is, you know, trying to save these animals because they're endangered, but also saving the habitat of these animals. Yeah.
Yeah. And like you said, then saving the habitat along with the animals is just protects everything else down below. And probably tons of species I've never heard of when it comes to the lizards and all the plants and everything in the area. Papua New Guinea is definitely on my bucket list, but I have not been there yet. And so now, Dr. Daybeck, you touched on it a little bit, but what are some of the conservation threats to these endangered tree kangaroos? What's happening in the wild?
Yeah.
What's the population estimates look like? Are they trending up? Are they trending down? How are we doing out there?
Yeah, so it varies across the island of New Guinea. And I work in Papua New Guinea, which is the country, the eastern half of the island. And there, for different species, either it can be habitat destruction, so from logging or mining or development. In the area where we work on the Huon Peninsula, which is a very remote area, no roads going in, and the villages, the communities are fairly spread out. There it's about hunting, over hunting. And it's not that the local landowners should not hunt tree kangaroos. It's just that they need to be managed as a resource, because tree kangaroos are very important to the local landowners, the local villagers. They eat the meat. They're actually the largest mammal of Papua New Guinea, which is unusual, you know, because it's not a large, it's about 20 pounds are tree kangaroos. But they're a good source of protein. And then their fur is also very important. They'll make headbands out of the tails or use the whole pelt in cultural dances and so on. And so one of the things and the one of the ways that we've approached conservation is that tree kangaroos are important to the local communities for cultural and for nutritional purposes. And so how can they continue to have a healthy population? And what happened was they were over hunting. And so then we really work with them to try to save them. And we can talk about that later if you want.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely want to talk about your work with the tree kangaroo conservation program for sure. So there are all the 14 species endangered or threatened?
Yeah, I would say they're, you know, from vulnerable to endangered. The two Australian species deal with very different issues. They deal with roads, and so they get hit by cars, and then also dogs end up killing tree kangaroos. So the threats are different in Australia.
Sure.
But in New Guinea, and we know so little about most of the species. And so there's now the beginnings of more work on the Goodfellows tree kangaroos. There's work on the Tenkile tree kangaroo species, but there's many species, and especially in the Indonesian side, that we just don't know enough about.
To really even give a population estimate or to even know if it's trending up. Do we think it's trending down, or we just don't have enough data?
For many of the species, we don't have enough data. For the Machi's tree kangaroo, we know that it's trending up because we're saving habitat. And in our case, as long as habitat is preserved and the local landowners are creating wildlife banks, so safe places for the animals to breed, then we know that they're doing well. And so that's exciting. I'm very optimistic about that. But there's a lot of work to be done on the other species.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Well, and that's actually a perfect lead-in to start talking about the Tree Kangaroo Conservation Program that you started during your graduate studies. So kudos to you. I could barely get two shoes on when I was in my graduate studies, let alone start a conservation organization, for goodness sakes. I'm wondering if you could give us a little background on the Tree Kangaroo Conservation Program, also often known as the TKCP, what the mission is.
Sure. Well, to be honest, I started the program after graduate school. So I completed my dissertation the next day, flew to Papua New Guinea to find out how I could use what I had learned in my research. I was looking at the reproductive behavior and biology of tree kangaroos. But
That's not what I did the day after I graduated. That's all I'm going to say. I think there were still tears and sleeping in bed for days involved. So no, just kidding. But yes, you flew to Papua New Guinea. You wanted to help out. And then?
Yeah. And then I learned about different projects that were going on in Papua New Guinea, learned that there was nothing going on the Machi's tree kangaroo. So then it took me another couple of years to raise enough money through zoos. So all of this work has been really supported through zoos and the Species Survival Plan, or SSP, for tree kangaroos. And I'm really proud to say that, because from day one, it has been a zoo-supported conservation program, and still to this day. And so after 2 years, we flew into the villages where we knew tree kangaroos were. We spent about 5 weeks talking to landowners, to hunters, we hiking up to try to find tree kangaroos. And we learned that in many of the areas of the forest, they were hunted out. But then we were introduced to the best tree kangaroo hunter in the area. Mampave is his name. And he took us to the forests of his family, of his clan. And we found a tree kangaroo. It was the first time I ever saw a wild tree kangaroo. You know, tears were, I was so excited to see the animal in the wild after all the years of studying them. And it was this magical moment, because with myself and my research partner at the time, and his and Mampave's family, they agreed to set that land aside so that we could do research. And they said they would not hunt tree kangaroos in that area. And that was the beginning. And so for several years, we were doing ecological research and population research on the tree kangaroos in the area. But hand in hand with that, we started talking to the communities and the landowners. And the wonderful thing about Papua New Guinea is that over 90% of the land and sea is owned by the local villagers. And that's recognized by the national government. And I don't know any other country like that. And so it's truly grassroots, and it means that they are the decision makers. So my role and the Tree Kangaroo Conservation Program role is to share knowledge, technologies, tools, to give the local landowners the information to make decisions about their resources, about their forests, about tree kangaroos. And so from day one, we looked at how can we also support the communities. So we started doing education projects. We started going into the schools. We set up a scholarship program for local teachers to be trained. And then eventually we started a health program, which has become a One Health initiative to integrate human, wildlife, and environmental health for the communities. And then we started a livelihoods program. They grow coffee in their communities. And so we've connected the coffee that they grow to the fact that they are conservation stewards. And now we sell conservation coffee. And so it's really an integrated program, but it started as focusing on the conservation status of the tree kangaroo, and then really talking to all of the landowners about setting aside portions of their forest, their hunting land, not all of it, not to stop hunting, but setting aside portions. And they coined it as wildlife banks. And so in wildlife banks, in those, you know, areas that are taboo, the animals can breed. The young can then disperse into the hunting grounds, and then they have they can use the interest. So it's quite logical.
Yeah, I've never heard that. A wildlife bank.
Yeah. And it turns out that traditionally, They used to have areas of the forest that were taboo for cultural reasons. They lost that practice. And so when we started talking about setting aside portions of the land or the forest, the elders said to me, you know, Lisa, this is not a new practice. We've done this before just for different reasons. So it also made sense to them to do this, which is one of the reasons why we've been successful.
I just love that story. I mean, you're spanning many, many years into a short little blurb here, but it's fascinating. And I just have to ask Dr. Dabick, after all the years of doing this and all the amazing progress you and your team have made, what's been your favorite aspect of directing the Tree Kangaroo Conservation Program?
That's a great question. So it's been 27 years that I've been working there, and it started quite small. And then after we created this conservation area, which is the first for the country, we then created an NGO, a local NGO. So we now have over 30 staff members from Papua New Guinea. It's now led by our director, Modi Pontio. She's our director there, so I collaborate with her. I think one of the best sort of moments for me, or what I'm most proud of, is that ability to pass on leadership locally. Yeah. And because we've been there for over a generation, we now have staff members that grew up, they were kids when I started the program, and now they are working with us, and they are the landowners who are actually now the conservationists as well. And that to me is the, you know, the best success of all.
Yeah, the full circle of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for the past 26 years, the accredited zoos, the AZA, they still continue to help support some of your mission. Is that correct?
It's really, truly amazing. We have a core group of zoos. You know, Woodland Park Zoo is the base of our operations, but the Santa Fe Teaching Zoo has been donating for decades. And it really is wonderful because we feel like a family. So all of the zoo people are part of the Tree Kangaroo Conservation Program. We started a SAFE program through AZA, which is Saving Animals from Extinction. So a Tree Kangaroo SAFE program, which then links all the education work, all the captive work with what we do in Papua New Guinea. And so it allows people here in the U.S. to be involved and feel like they're making a difference in Papua New Guinea. And it connects the people of Papua New Guinea and our team there with people here. And so we have people from zoos that go over there, zookeepers, veterinarians,
podcasters,
podcasters. Of course, we can figure it. We need to tell our story.
That is very true. Yes.
New directors, all kinds of people can come over, but it's really, and that's been really wonderful. We just, we've had grant writers go over and trainer people, and And I think that is part of what is exciting to me, is that it truly takes a village. It truly takes a community of all different experts coming together from all different aspects, whether it's animal health or whether it's behavior or whether it's livelihoods or education, to make this work.
Yeah, and that's one of the things we always talk about on the podcast, or when I have students or people reaching out to me. Here's what I like to do. How can I help? Or I think I want to do conservation science, but I really like media or something. And I just always try to share that the science aspect of it, of, of course, is a lovely route to go down. Not easy, but definitely a lovely route. And many more great conservation scientists and biologists and field workers are needed. But it's not the only. It's not the only route. I've had people that make jewelry reach out to me and sell their jewelry to raise proceeds for a wildlife conservation group. I've had people reach out to me, and I've set them up with other nonprofits to volunteer their time to help with social media. And so. That's where I love the analogy, like you're saying, of a village. Is it does take all the different talents, and then that's how it can really grow and blossom. And it's just such an incredible thing that you've started. And like you said, now they're doing a lot on their own over in Papua New Guinea. Now, do you still travel there sometimes?
Yes. There was, you know, a period of time because of COVID that I couldn't. That was a really interesting time, but now I'm back to going. I go over twice a year, and that's been wonderful. This last trip in October of 2023, we had both a research team and a veterinarian team that went over. We were GPS collaring more tree kangaroos, so we were up at our field camp collaring animals, getting research samples. And then we had a week of a One Health workshop, and we had volunteer physicians from the US that came over and did health education, nutrition, clinics, and then talking to the government health departments to try to support healthcare for these remote communities. So we really, I mean, it truly is people from all different fields that have contributed.
Yeah, it's just so incredible. And hopefully maybe someday I can be one of those people. I'm very very good at behavioral data. And like, I'm telling you my resume right now. And I'm like a poop expert, so I can collect poop anywhere, anyhow, no questions asked.
We have a bond there. After I saw the first tree kangaroo, that first trip, it was 7 years until I saw another tree kangaroo. We were just collecting dung. Mm-hmm. So I can relate to you.
Yeah. Well, and our listeners out there that think we're silly ladies, but the fecal matter can tell you a lot about the animal. And so and in a very non-invasive way. So
my dissertation research was extracting hormones from the dung of tree kangaroos. And I was able to show that the reproductive cycle of a female tree kangaroo is about 55 days. So almost every 2 months they cycle, they come and test us for only 2 days. And and that was all non-invasive, which is amazing. Yeah.
Work. So cool. And Dr. Daybuck, how can our listeners learn more about the amazing work that you're doing for tree kangaroos and their conservation at the Woodland Park Zoo? How can they learn more about it if they're interested?
Yeah, so the easiest way is to go onto our website, which is www.treekangaroo.org. That's an easy way. And on that, we have videos of our field conservation work. We have videos about our coffee project. We do annual reports and so on. You can see images from our work. And we've also partnered with National Geographic using critter cams. Cool. So you can also see video footage if you go onto the National Geographic website of critter cams of what tree kangaroos do 100 feet up in the air in the canopy. You also can go to many zoos. There are 20 zoos in the country where you can go and actually see tree kangaroos. At Woodland Park Zoo, we're really excited because we're working on a new exhibit that will open in 2026, and it's going to highlight tree kangaroos and also highlight the tree kangaroo conservation program. So people can learn all about what we do in Papua New Guinea and all about our coffee program and really have the voices of the people from Papua New Guinea, as well as seeing the animals. So I always tell people, once you see a tree kangaroo, you fall in love.
It's 100%. Really, yes. It's simple math. That's exactly what happens.
And there's also a great book by Cy Montgomery. And it's that is about the tree kangaroo conservation program. And so you can look up, if you Google tree kangaroo book, that will come up. Awesome. And it's The Ghosts of the Tree, The Ghosts of the Forest.
Well, and we will definitely link all of that on our show notes for our listeners, so you can have easy access to treekangaroo.org, the Critter Cams, National Geographic, and the Tree Kangaroo book as well. And Woodland Park as well, too, probably following them on Woodland Park Zoo, probably following them on social media, so you can
absolutely
learn more about what they have going on there and all the conservation work.
We now have an official, and it's recognized by the Papua New Guinea government, World Tree Kangaroo Day, which is May 21st.
Oh my goodness, we have to celebrate
and
that.
Most of the zoos in North America, actually around the world, celebrate World Tree Kangaroo Day now. And so I also encourage people to look at all the different zoos, because a lot of our zookeepers are now filming the young, the joeys. There's new ways of filming in the pouch and watching the development of the young. And it's really fascinating. So technology is incredible.
So
that's another way to learn more about tree kangaroos.
With the social media and some of these technological advances, it really is an exciting time. And just the fact that you're able to put the collars on them as well in the wild is just to learn even more about them and keep track of them. It's just, I do think it is a very exciting time for conservation because of a lot of the tools that we have now and the way we can share information and get people excited about that. You and I love looking at tree kangaroos and love everything about them, but a lot of people haven't heard about them. So that would be my advice to listeners. If you like this episode, definitely check out the treekangaroo.org website, Woodland Park Zoo, Google them and just fall in love and share this podcast episode with a friend and just talk about tree kangaroos, because you may be the only one in the room that's ever heard of them, and they're definitely very cute and endangered. They do need more to be more of the conversation, I think.
Yeah, they're a great conversation opener.
They are. Definitely.
who's heard of a tree kangaroo? Yeah. My goal in life is that everyone should know what a tree kangaroo is.
Well, Dr. Daybook, I think that's a great goal, and I am here to help support you in that however you need, especially if you need me to help you over in Papua New Guinea. Anything you need.
Let's talk.
Awesome. And then my last question, just because you've had such a brilliant career and you've done so much, I was wondering if you had advice for someone wanting to get into the field of conservation biology or science. What would you tell them?
Yeah, what I advise is, if you truly are interested in the science aspect, whether you're in high school now or, grade school or college, I mean, you definitely need that foundation of good science and math. And I think it's really important to follow your passion. And so, like we were talking about earlier, if it's not actually the science part of it, or the veterinary science part of it, there are many other ways to do conservation, whether it's from the social sciences or from education or the arts. I think there's many ways to approach conservation. But I think for conservation biology, and there are a lot of organizations where you can do internships. There's a great new organization called Conservation Nation. And that is really focused on supporting young women and people of color to get into the field of conservation. I'm on the advisory council for them. And so you could Google that, Conservation Nation. But I think it's one of the things that I'm really trying to promote is more Indigenous-led conservation. Mm-hmm. And so that there are many ways to get involved, and it doesn't have to be a very privileged field. Mm-hmm. And so there's, you know, also I get a lot of calls or emails from young people that just want to know more or talk about it. So I encourage people to reach out, do informational interviews mm-hmm. with people that you are interested in learning about, or the animal that you're interested in learning about, because we love to talk about the animals we study. So
absolutely. And we'll tell you all the pros and a few of the cons, and then you can decide. But I love the ideas of internships too, just because it's a short time period for you to get thrust into something and see if it's a good fit or not. And that definitely helped shape me in my career of like, oh, I do like this, but this not so much.
And so, exactly. And I think that zoos are a great place. I think, you know, zoos more and more, and over my career, really play a role in conservation. So also explore, you know, careers within zoos. That's a great way as well.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Dr. Lisa Daybick, it has been an honor today mm-hmm. to get a chance to talk to you and just have a quick little tour of your incredible career and all the things you've done from the ground up overseas and at home too at the Woodland Park Zoo and then throughout North America. So it's very inspiring, and it's and knowing too that it does take a village. I definitely agree with that, especially to do the big, bold, brilliant things that the tree conservation, kangaroo tree conservation program is doing. But it often starts with just an individual. And I want to thank you for being that individual, for seeing something, questioning it, not really liking it, and then wanting to make a difference and having that initial start. And then, of course, you teamed up with amazing people to help you, and the zoos stepped up and all of that. But it started with an original creator and to get the ball moving. So I think that's a very inspirational story. And I just love sharing that message that really anybody can work towards making mm-hmm. a difference. And then the group comes in and then you make an even bigger difference. So
well, thank you.
Yes. Thank you. Yes. Hats off to you. And we're definitely going to make sure and post all of the links on our social media to make sure that people can get in touch with what you're doing, and our listeners know where to find you on social media. So that's www.treekangaroo.org. You can also check out the Woodland Park Zoo and all of their social media websites and critter cams and Nat Geo. I did not know that they had a tree kangaroo critter cam, so I'm pretty excited. I know what I'll be doing this evening. I'll be eating my popcorn, watching some tree kangaroos because they're just so darn cute. That's so great. And yeah, we'll just keep this conversation going because I want to check in more frequently and see how you're doing. And we'll be all over the place in social media on May 21st, which is World Tree Kangaroo Day. So it's an exciting time. And I want to thank everybody for listening. And once again, Dr. Daybick, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Okay. Bye-bye. Okay.